What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, Daniel Mate on finding his own path alongside his famous father, Gabor Mate, and the book they wrote together, The Myth of Normal, which looks at the health crisis taking place worldwide. We'll also be discussing his connection to the Palestinian solidarity community here in Ireland. And I'll also be joined by relationship expert Shelley Whitehead to discuss healing from heartbreak. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, you know me at this stage. I love the slower pace when the kids are off school. So I've been leaning into the Easter holiday vibe and been enjoying the change in the air since the clock stole that hour from us last weekend. And I had two lovely work days this week having my photos taken. I'm sprucing up my website, nourishyourself.ie. So I spent a couple of days on the beach, in the woods and in studios posing it up. And it was lovely. And I'll tell you why, because it's been tricky for me to get my head around adding a health coach business to my presenter CV. I suppose imposter syndrome comes to all of us. But lately, I've decided to step more into the role. I've let it evolve quite slowly and carefully. And this week, I felt it. Not that I was playing a role, but that it was my role. So that was a really good feeling. And you know, one of the nicest parts I wanted to tell you about, because we took photos on the beach at sunrise in Wicklow, which is actually a bit of a trek from where I live, I booked myself into Powerscourt Springs the night before by myself. Now, it's so lovely to go away with your partner, your family, your friends, the girls. I love it. But let me tell you, going on your own is an absolute game changer. To potter about in silence at my own pace, eat dinner on my own, float about the spa area. I left the sauna when I was ready. I went back to my room when I was ready. I absolutely loved it. So if it's something you have ever considered, this is your sign to book yourself a solo date. Overnight, I'll say, if you can, but even a few hours and you will thank me later. And a reminder, I'll be in Cork on Sunday the 28th of August at Ballymaloe Grain Store for a beautiful day dedicated to rest with Dr. Fiona Barry. And tickets for Rest Revolution in Cork are on Eventbrite. And you'll find out more info on my Instagram. And I am interviewing Jerry Hussey this week about his book, The Freedom Within, Wednesday, April 10th in Windmill Quarter for Dublin Book Festival. And you'll get tickets at dublinbookfestival.com. You can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, Shelley J. Whitehead is an award-winning relationship coach known for her profound insight into love, loss and personal growth. She's just published her book, Healing Your Heartbreak, 28 Days to Transformation, and she joins me on the line now. Well, Shelley, you're very welcome.
Good morning. It's lovely to be with you.
Shelley, tell me a little about the path to becoming a relationship coach.
Well, I have the NIS3 qualifications, as in I have two coaching qualifications. What I've done is I've combined a lot of my own life experience, because I do what I do because I've been there. I've been bereaved, I've been dumped, I've been divorced. I'm no stranger to pain, heartache, grief, and it's my greatest joy in being able to help my clients transition those really dark days of uncertainty into creating a life they love again. And that's really why I wrote the book.
Because when we think about health and well-being, often because of what we've been given, I suppose, by the media in many ways and the health and wellness message, we sort of think about food and exercise, whereas it's so much more complex than that. And relationships have a massive impact on our well-being. They can either take from them or really give to our well-being.
Oh, completely, Claire. There was a study done some years ago. It was a Harvard study conducted over 75 years about happiness and what made, you know, the subjects happy. And the conclusion was, it was the quality of the relationships in their lives. And of course, when they go wrong, unhappiness ensues. And, you know, digging oneself out of that deep hole can be a real challenge.
So how important to our well-being is it that we find a romantic partner? Do you believe, Shelley, in the one?
I believe in the ones. I believe our heart's capacity to love is incredibly, it's great. There can often be a really, really special one. But it takes more than just love to make a relationship great. Great relationships don't just happen. They are made. So, you know, should a relationship end, if one desires, there can be another one. But we must know what we're looking for.
I often like to think about love like a jigsaw, and that there's all different types of love that make up the one picture. So there can be your romantic partner or your life partner, your friendships, your family, your work colleagues, and everyone gives love and gives you a different special relationship in a different way.
I agree with you, Clay. A relationship, an intimate relationship, is not our life. It's part of our life. And when I speak about, you know, I work with couples as well, but when I speak about the areas that we need to focus on as a couple, it's the physical relationship, which is the one thing that generally makes, you know, differentiates this relationship to any other relationship we have with anyone else. It's the emotional, it's the social, it's the financial, and then it's the energetic, you know, whatever we put into that relational space. You know, the fun, the adventure, the trust. You know, in the book, I have 12 core ingredients of a healthy relationship, and those are part of them. So friendships are amazing. They're all these other puzzle pieces, as you say, that feed into our life. And we need to be very careful we don't make the relationship our entire life.
Yes, you are an advocate for finding a balance between time together and time apart for the health of a relationship. Because I often think about that jigsaw, because it's quite a lot to expect one person to give you all of those things that you mentioned there. That's a lot of pressure on one person.
It is. One of the most amazing relationship therapists, Esther Perel, also addresses this. Is that, you know, many years ago we had, you know, the village that supported so many of our needs. And now we live in isolation and we expect our partner to be our everything, our friend, our lover, our companion, the one who helps, you know, the co-parenter. And it is just too much for one person. Having space and other people who feed these needs is essential. We need to take responsibility for creating that ourselves and not just dumping it all on this other person, expecting that they are the source of everything and happiness.
So what's the number one reason that causes couples to break up?
I believe it's a lack of connection. And connection for me has four components, and this is what I teach. Connection means I feel safe with you. I trust you. We are a team and we have one another's backs. Most people think it's a lack of communication. I speak about four C's that are essential for a relationship, an intimate one. There must be chemistry. The second thing is compatibility, and compatibility equals values. If we have different values, as in, you know, one's into wheatgrass, which is that healthy substance, and the other one's into cocaine, clearly you have different values. It's never going to work. Then, of course, connection, the safe, the trust, the team, having one another's backs. Lastly, the communication. If the couple do not have connection, they don't feel safe, they don't trust one another, they're not working together as a team, they don't have one another's backs, chemistry is going to go, compatibility obviously is not there, and the communication will die.
And what about the term we hear a lot, we just grew apart? Because I think when you're together for a long time, like decades, and, you know, if my husband's listening and we're approaching our second decade, you know, I'm not talking about us, but you're a very different person in many ways to the one at the start of the relationship. So is it natural sometimes after 10, 20, 30 years that people will grow apart?
Definitely. You know, if we're a couple who get together and then we have children, very often our values change. And, you know, one may be more of the supporter, enhancer, nurturer with the children, and the other one is, you know, more of that provider, protector out there, you know, holding it all together financially. Or both individuals may be doing that. Our values can change, but also our needs change. And then the children leave home. And then, oh, who are you again? What are we going to do? We got stuck in a rut because we do need to be having fun and adventure and exploring the world together in many different life areas. So if we're unhappy within ourselves and we got into a personal rut, our relationship can get into a rut too. Growing together is essential. And as I said in the beginning, great relationships don't just happen. They're made. It's what we put into them. The energy we put into it is going to be what we're living in and what we're feeding off. So it's so easy to grow apart, and life can be, you know, full of stress. I think stress probably is one of the number one reasons couples grow apart, where they don't manage their own stress and they don't look after the relationship.
Yeah, and people are busy now and under pressure, and that rut can come, I suppose, quicker than ever. Let's talk about heartbreak then, when a relationship ends. It is the topic of your book. It's a massive experience, isn't it? It's physical, it's emotional, it's a mix of grief, loss, and having to find the energy to start again alone.
It can be devastating. You know, as I say, I'm no stranger to that, and I have been there. Finding out who we are without our significant other is, you know, in itself a huge journey. Grief ensues when the relationship ends, and we literally go through the same process of grieving as when someone dies. Although bereavement is a lot longer, I work with many bereaved clients as well. But when a relationship ends, you know, the utter shock and denial, even if we've ended it because we needed to for some other reason or whatever it is, there's this denial, the anger, the bargaining, that depressed state, acceptance, and eventually we come to meaning. And it doesn't necessarily go in that order. I was just speaking to someone in the Middle East this morning, a client who's in deep grief about his relationship that has ended. And he's, you know, in this very depressed state right now. So understanding that it's grief, working through grief, we don't bypass it, we go through it. But they're very helpful steps in the book to help us to understand what to do in this state. And then, you know, putting in those very necessary boundaries again. I call it finding sunshine, everything that makes sense in our life that lifts our state from where it is, you know, into a different state. Doing an inventory, because we tend to go into a fantasy about the relationship, wishing either that this person's going to come back or we could be different and it'll make everything different, instead of really looking at why did it end? What wasn't working? What do I want to be different?
Yeah, I remember many years ago breaking up with a long-term partner in a relationship that wasn't working, even though there was a lot of mutual love there. And in the lead up to the breakup, all I could think about was the bad things or the negative things or the reasons it wasn't working. And the minute the breakup happened, it was like a switch went off. All I could think about were the good times and the good things. And it's crazy how your mindset can shift like that. I was watching a video on your Instagram page, and you were talking about heartbreak as a trauma. And when we're in trauma, our ability to focus is very limited. Do we need to give ourselves time to be in that zone, to wallow for a little before we start finding that sunshine you mentioned?
100%. When someone dies, you know, people come around with food and cards and their support, and there's a whole ritual for grieving. When a relationship ends, very often people are saying, look, you've just got to get over this. Why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? When the individual isn't ready, it's grief. We don't rush grief. We don't get stuck in it either. But that ability to, you know, not being able to focus is a very natural state. The body, the mind, everything, emotionally and physically, has gone into survival. And we do need to be very kind with ourselves and go back to the essential basics, working on getting better sleep, nourishing the body, so often people can't eat. I mean, I know myself, I lost 10 kilograms, which I couldn't really afford to lose. But I pay a lot of attention to that with my clients in just the basic structure, getting the support, finding something that lifts the state, and creating space for healing. We need to heal from heartbreak, you know, as one would with a broken limb. It has a specific healing time. We don't want to get stuck and we don't want to do the wrong things. We can definitely, you know, self-medicate unhealthily. And that doesn't facilitate healing.
And I mentioned the physical response. I mean, we do talk about a broken heart and obviously the organ itself is still beating, but you can really feel it in your chest, or as you mentioned, an anxiety in your stomach that can often affect how you eat. It is a very physical reaction.
Very much so. There's a whole lot of chemistry going on in the body as well, and very often elevated cortisol levels, where people sometimes describe it as a whirring, you know, circular whirring in the middle of the chest, inability to swallow, as in food, you know, they can probably drink a smoothie. So much is going on physically, including the crazy circling thoughts going on in the mind, because the brain is now devoid of a whole lot of chemistry. There's lower dopamine, lower oxytocin, you know, all the bonding chemicals are not there. We just don't have that person in our lives, and that creates the fantasy and this whole physical reaction. People have been known to die from a broken heart.
And we have recent research about loneliness and the impact that that can have on our health being akin to the damage that cigarettes can cause. So, you know, there is a real tie between that health and that well-being that we touched on before. You've put a number of days in your title and in the book, 28 Days to Transformation, same in your online course.
Yes.
Does that intone that there comes a time when you have to stop looking back and you have to move on? I mean, I'm sure people will go past the 28 days or go at their own pace, but why did you choose a specific time?
Because the information broken down into tiny steps is very doable. You will look back after going through this process, after 28 days, very differently. Perspective is everything. If we change the way we look at things, you know, that famous quote, gaining perspective, this is where everything, you know, starts to change. It's about making sense of it all. And it doesn't mean that healing is complete. Gosh, I find myself still working on so much. And, you know, I've been doing this work for nearly 18 years. But, you know, if we shift our perspective, we can watch the whole world transform. So out of the fantasy thinking into really looking at the reality of what was going on, where our needs were met, where they weren't met, you know, what we want more of, what we've learned about ourselves as a person coming through, you know, the 28 days, how we are with boundaries internally, externally. So it doesn't mean that, you know, you're done and dusted. It takes people generally, when they're working with someone and they're going through a really good process, about 3 months, 12 weeks. The 28 days is an intense, easy formula for healing, and it facilitates profound healing where you're really clear about who you are and what you're looking forward to. Because the one thing that ends when our relationship ends is this whole vision of the future. And the one thing we do create is a new vision. And that's very, very powerful.
Well, the book is called Healing Your Heartbreak, 28 Days to Transformation. Shelley J. Whitehead, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Claire.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with privacy mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again. Now,
You're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's one.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, Daniel Mate is a composer and lyricist based in New York, where he also runs his mental chiropractic service called Take a Walk with Daniel. He recently co-authored The Myth of Normal with his father, Gabor Mate, taking a look at the Western health system, which despite technological advancements and much financial investment, our society is sicker and sadder than ever. He was recently in Ireland to give a number of talks, and he stopped by the News Talk studio for a conversation with me too. Daniel, you are very welcome.
Well, thank you so much. I'm very pleased to be welcomed here.
You are at the end of a whirlwind around Ireland. You arrived into Cork. Was it a week ago you were holding a training seminar?
Yeah, just about. Yeah. And I had a couple of gigs there. One was more or less a training seminar focused around the book you have in front of you, The Myth of Normal, as well as a sort of pilot presentation and demonstration about my own modality that I've developed over the last 5 or 6 years called mental chiropractic. So it was focused around mental health, mental upkeep, things like that, for a group of psychotherapists from across the country, and a few people flew in from elsewhere. And then I did a more political event the following night at a local pub.
Yeah, there's been a lot of that. I mean, obviously online you've been sharing a lot about solidarity with the Palestinians, mm-hmm. and there's a huge community here in Ireland, and you joined forces along the way.
Yeah, and I'm doing so again here in Dublin tonight on my last day here as we're recording this. And the event in Galway actually also was not entirely focused on that, but it was a central I think, pillar of the event, the interview with Sheila Scheuge. Yeah, I've never seen anything like the level of solidarity and affinity and really transnational unity between Ireland and Palestine. I know that the government has now gotten on board the South African genocide case at the ICJ, but I'm talking about the people here. I've seen plenty of... cinema set in this country, and it's no surprise to be in a pub with people singing along, but to have a group of Irish people singing along to From the River to the Sea, Palestine Will Be Free, to a tune and instrumentation that sounds very, very homegrown, or to be at the Galway event and to hear, Sharon Shannon playing the squeeze box on a song that a woman named Roy Sheen, I forget her last name, is singing. And at certain points, I couldn't tell if it was Arabic or Gaelic. The two languages started sounding the same to me. And another woman, also named Roy Sheen, Al-Shefri, was there, a Palestinian-Irish woman. So a literal, the twain meeting. And just the deep feeling that people in this country have for that struggle is deeply moving and almost incomprehensible to me.
And I wanted to ask you about music, because you're also a composer and a lyricist, and the power of music to bring people together. I could only watch the event in one rows online, but to see that connection and the power of music to bring people together, it's an incredible force.
Well, sure it is. I mean, people call it the international language, or it's something human beings, it's one of the core evidence of any genius that our species has is in the fact that we have this thing called music. It might be the most elemental art form and the most visceral way of communicating with each other outside of spoken language. And yeah, the vibrations of the different kinds of music that belong to different lands tell you so much about that place that even reading history books and intellectual learning, or even speaking to people, can't quite communicate. I know I had an experience in December and January when I went to a couple of Palestinian cultural events in Brooklyn. And, you know, I've always fancied myself as someone who's in solidarity with Palestine, especially when compared to most Jewish people, who many of whom still have a deep emotional allegiance to the country that's put Palestine through hell. But what I realized at that concert was I'm woefully ignorant about what Palestine feels like to Palestinians. And the music really communicated it. And the fact that they projected the translated lyrics on the wall behind the singers and the musicians allowed me as a lyricist, you mentioned my composing, I'm also a lyricist, it's for musical theater, that's my domain. But to see the stories being told and the particular character of the humor and the pathos and the grief and the heartbreak as expressed incredibly in lyrics that are just unlike anything I've seen anywhere else. The references to the land and the sensual connection that's kept alive in the memory of these lyrics. I'm talking about, you know, the smell of citrus groves and the touch of certain indigenous flowers and just the corporeal belongingness to that land from which they've experienced the most wrenching disconnection imposed on them and are still fighting for their freedom. And a big part of that is keeping those memories alive, and the music does that. The stories do that. The lyrics do that. So all of this to say that I considered myself pretty knowledgeable before that, but knowledge and knowing are two different things.
Yeah. And feeling, that's really, really powerful stuff, as is coming together and being open to sharing insights and learning and experiencing. And I just think that's been really, really powerful to see. And there's a statistic in the book, which we'll get to, The Myth of Normal, in a moment, but it's about the apathy a lot of young people feel about the world. Now, it's in particular to climate change, mm-hmm. that there's a hopelessness. But I think a lot of people feel a sort of hopelessness for what is going on. And it's really important that communities continue to come together and keep that hope alive and become activists and stand up and speak out for what they believe is right and be open to learn and move forward.
That's true. And I would add a couple of, I think, necessary caveats to that. Number one, before we can encourage people to shake off the doldrums of apathy and indifference or cynicism and get active, I think we have to have the kind of compassion we advocate in one of the chapters late in the book called the compassion of understanding and the compassion of context to get why, for many young people, that checking out is a highly rational response, in fact, to what they've been born into. And when we talk down to them and say, you know, come on, where's your spirit? It's up to you to save the world. That's just more of it, because they've been handed a mess. And one of my favorite authors, Stephen Jenkinson, who I find myself quoting all the time, a fellow Canadian, says that in a sense, you can tell the young people that it's not too late if you want them to vote for you, but not if you want them to respect you. It is too late for certain things. There are things to grieve, you know, and we can't do activism except from a place of reckoning with reality as it is. And so I have a certain amount of skepticism about the concept of hope itself. I'm very much an advocate of possibility, because possibility doesn't require that anything change. Possibility always starts from this moment and starting from a profound relationship to reality that doesn't resist the way it is. And then what's possible? What would be inspiring? What would be redeeming of our humanity in this moment, as opposed to hope, which in the sense that the word is often used has something to do with hooking our positivity on a future that, truth be told, we don't have much control over. And it can lead to a kind of vortex where hope is hopeless. So it's not a bad word. I think it's an overused word and an oversold word. And capitalism loves hope because it's always deferring the dream. And I can understand why peoples who are struggling for their freedom need to keep a certain amount of hope. But yeah, that word gives me a certain amount of pause. And so, but certainly nihilism and apathy and giving up is only one possible response to the possibly hopeless situation we're in, because we're still human. And even if we found out that there was no hope, even if we found out that the world was going to end tomorrow, just as a thought experiment, how would we want to go out? Who would we want to be in the face of it? And in my fantasy world, worst case scenario, the lights of planet Earth go out, and just before it all blows up, a single human being looks up and suddenly goes, oh, okay, I get it. And just has a moment of total clarity and seeing the cosmic joke. Now, that's cold comfort, of course, to those who love life and love humanity. But what I'm pointing to, I think, is that we need to meet the youth where they're at and listen to them of what would give them more of a sense of being human, and allow them to become who they can be, the best they can be in this moment, with as little agenda as possible.
Because there's quite a lot of anger around at the moment and judgment. And if I'm going to call it out, I have to be aware of my own judgment of that. But I saw it in the pandemic. People were judging how people were reacting, what people were doing.
Absolutely.
And it's back again. Who cares more about what's happening in the world? Who's speaking up enough? How are you speaking up? What actions are you taking? Is that a very natural reaction for us as humans as we begin to work through what's happening?
Well, I don't know what's natural. The entire book, Myth of Normal, is predicated on the idea that much of what we consider normal is in fact not natural, if we understand the word natural to mean related to nature, as in our nature, which would have to be correlated with how we evolved. And we actually evolved not in a vacuum, but in relationship to a particular kind of environment, which is to say, mostly small band hunter-gatherer groups, where all the conditions for becoming human and humane were met, naturally speaking. You didn't need parenting books, because the intelligence of nature had created a living situation where children were almost guaranteed to get not just their basic survival needs, but their emotional attunement needs, their being taken care of needs, their sense of collective meaning needs, and their opportunity to actually graduate from childhood into adulthood through some kind of vertically administered rite of passage, you know, a process that's actually overseen by people who've gone through it. That's not the world we're living in. So it's very, very dodgy, I think, to look for what's natural in a world like this. The premise of the book is that much of the ill health we're seeing, whether on the physical or mental level, and those two things are not actually separable, is a natural and normal response, reaction, consequence to the way our world is currently set up. So that said, maybe a better question would be, is it understandable? Sure. Is it to be expected? Yes, especially in an environment where the powers that be and the media that serves them faithfully benefit and profit from us being divided. And COVID was a great example. And I don't care where you fall on the efficacy of vaccines or lockdowns or any of that, but there was a tremendous amount of dogmatism and mistrust and making other people wrong that was absolutely fostered by our media elite and government, and kind of not coincidentally, it cohered with what would make certain corporations a lot of money, you know? And I'm not being a conspiracy theorist here. I don't think you need conspiracies to understand how the system works. I learned that from Noam Chomsky. It doesn't require a conspiracy. It's just how it works. It's sort of structural analysis. And then, of course, you had people on the other side of it projecting a lot of things and making people wrong who were making their own choices, you know, whether informed or ill-informed choices around their own health. And there was just a lot of rancor. You know, I'm not here to take sides exactly, but I do know, but I'm always inclined to criticize my own side before the side that's supposed to be the other side. And my own side is on the liberal side of the North American political spectrum, the educated side, the urban side, the coastal side. That's just where I grew up. And among my people, I saw a horrifying, almost religious attachment to some notion of science that was rather absolutist. So is that natural? In a sense, it was very understandable in the early days of the pandemic. I don't think there's any way around it. You hear there's a global pandemic. You don't know where it's coming from. You don't know what to do. For all we know, it might be very, 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 very deadly to everyone. Of course, panic is completely natural. At a certain point, other factors, external factors, systemic factors take over, and they either help us get more grounded in reality or deeper into our positionality and our identity around what our position is. And that's what I saw happen. And that to me is not at all natural. It's one could say nurtural, to coin a phrase.
Yeah, I like that. You need to trademark that one. Right, well, we will have to take a quick break. You're listening to Alive and Kicking here on News Talk with Claire McKenna, where I'm joined by Daniel Mate. And when we come back, we'll discuss the book he co-authored with his father, Gabor Mate, The Myth of Normal, Trauma, Illness and Healing in a Toxic Culture.
Alive and Kicking on News Talk.
You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking, where I'm joined in studio by Daniel Mate. And let's talk about the book then. We've touched it on a couple of times, The Myth of Normal, Trauma, Illness and Healing in a Toxic Culture. You wrote it with your father, Gabor Mate.
Yeah, and I should say in this interview, I'm completely speaking for myself. When I talk about the book, I'll talk about what's in the book. But what I just said, for instance, this is not Mate Corp's position on anything. I'm just speaking for myself.
Yeah, so you're keeping that nurturalization trademark to yourself.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He can't have that one. He doesn't need it.
Your father is at great pains in the introduction to say that this book was written 50-50. And I always think it's a strange thing to ask somebody almost what's it like to have a famous father, because that's the only father that you know. But is there any sense of having to step outside of a shadow of your father? Are you happy to collaborate? Clearly you are because of the book and you're working on another now. But is that something you have to navigate or at least answer many questions about, mine included?
Oh, it's a lifelong navigation. I should say, I don't think the claim is that it was 50-50. If you look at the cover of the book, I think the proportional sizes of the fonts in which our respective names are written pretty much indicates the, in some ways, the division of labor, but really the sort of who owns the book, who is responsible for it existing, you know, in the sense that it was, the impetus was his, the lifetime of professional experience and expertise is his. I'm not even a therapist. I call myself a mental chiropractor, which is a whole other thing, but I haven't done that work. I'm not a trauma expert. I haven't traveled the world and spoken to thousands of people. I haven't led the sorts of retreats he has, and his interests are not my interests. I came aboard as a co-author to help get the thing written and to make sure it was as good, as readable, as tight, light, and bright as it could be, given the heaviness and the girth of the subject matter presented, and to support him in making sure that his message was as clear and persuasive as it could be and as accessible to as wide an audience as possible, not just people who were already aboard his way of looking at things or people who are already conversant in trauma talk and things like that. It was very important to me that, given that this book is about the world we're living in, that it be really inviting to anyone who's concerned about the state of the world we're living in. So that's not a small mandate. You know, that's not an editor in the background, but it's also not a ghostwriter. And so I wouldn't say the writing was 50-50. Certainly the research was not close to 50-50. But the sign-off on are we happy with this chapter was, I think, generally speaking, you could say that the beginnings and the endings of the chapter was one of my specialties. How do we get into it? How do we come out of it? What are the ligaments that connect one chapter to the next? What's the overall structure of the book? I really helped in the book proposal. I played to my strengths. I'm a collaborator in musical theater writing. I'm a lyricist. I'm a composer. I have a feel for the music of language, the importance of certain word choices and how to keep things light and interesting and give it some punch, and how to make an argument carefully. These are skills I brought to the table, without which it wouldn't be the book it is. And it's primarily his book. And I'm proud to have been involved at that level. In fact, I wouldn't have wanted to be involved at a more equal level. It wouldn't have been appropriate. And for my first foray into being a published author, I mean, he's done this four times before. It was a nice sort of manageable assignment that I embraced. Now, our next book is 50-50 explicitly. And if our names are presented in alphabetical order, mine will come first on the cover. And it makes sense that it's 50-50 because the title of it is Hello Again, A Fresh Start for Parents and Adult Children. Well, that's us. And it's based on a workshop we've been leading together for 6 or 7 years now, actually coming up on 8 years, of which I'm at least a 50% partner in creating the curriculum and the structure of it, if not slightly more, just because I think it was more urgent for me, this topic. But we've really done it together, and we're doing this book together. So that's the division of labor. As far as your, I think what your main question was, which I've been circling around, what's it like to have a famous father? He wasn't always this famous. So I've had time to ease into it the way he has. It's been challenging, especially since my main passion, musical theater, hasn't taken off, hasn't gotten me really any musicals produced in North America, at least. The last major production I had of a musical was in Denmark in 2017. I've won some awards, some pretty major awards for my writing, but those are awards for promise and merit and talent, not for commercial achievement. So being recognized as my father's co-author or collaborator is still recognition by association. And it's not, I've had to deal with my own internal voice saying, oh, your writing is coattails and things like that. No one else says that to me except people who hate me for my political activism, which I can, that's fine. I can take that. But since October 7th, actually, is the first time that people are saying, oh my God, I've been following you for months. I only just clued into who your father is. And as much as I hate the circumstances in which that's transpired, I can't say I hate that turn of events. I'm 48 years old. You want to be standing on your own two feet and doing your own work in the world. And I've been a late bloomer in a lot of ways, so I can't complain. And it's happening in its own time. But working with him has been very good scaffolding, actually, for developing a separate identity. Because in order to work with him and contribute to him, I can't be him. I have to bring something else. I have to figure out, well, what is it that I do that he can't do? What does he need from me? Which then allows me to draw boundaries that I wasn't able to draw as a child and haven't previously been able to draw, because I'm like, hey, you need me. Here's what I need in order to be at my best to help you. So it's actually been, I wouldn't have thought it, that in some ways my emancipation from some of those complexes and neuroses and difficulties would be through going right into the eye of the storm and working with the man. But it's worked out that way. And I think if you'd told me when I was a kid that that would be the trajectory, I think I would have thought that would be pretty cool.
And how incredible to have that parallel going as you're working on these workshops and this book about healing in adults and what do you bring to the relationship later on in life. Before I let you go, I just wanted to touch on your work as a mental chiropractor, because it's such an interesting way, the way I sort of think about it. When you go to the chiropractor, you sort of get a crack and a shock and it sort of levels things out. So on your walks with people, is that in a sense what can happen?
Yeah, that's exactly how I envisioned it. Now, someone else dubbed me a mental chiropractor and I kept it because it fits so well with my approach. I'm impatient. I'm eager to get to that moment of crystal clarity. And I don't have my dad's capacity or appetite for sitting with people's deepest traumas and connecting the dots back to their childhood. I assume people are traumatized. My question is, where are you stuck now? And if it's useful for us to refer to the origins of some of these patterns, we will. That's fine. I know full well from my own life that current difficulties have many origins in the past, but they're playing out in the present. And there's a lot we can do in the present. And mental chiropractic is designed to start from, as you would do if you're going to a chiropractor, where's the complaint? Where is it hurting? What's the stuckness? Not where did it come from, not what's the old injury really, but how is it manifesting? And you know, a misalignment in the spine can, you can feel it in your foot, you can feel it in your left ear, you can feel it all over the place. The whole system is affected by a misalignment at the core of the structure of the system. And alignment is relative to how the thing is designed. Kind of what I said about human nature, right? We have a certain design, and when the environment is out of whack, we don't live up to our potential. When something's misaligned in the mind, whatever the origins of that are, it's going to create a stuckness in our lives. And stuckness is an experience of not being able to move forward with something, not being able to let go of something, not being able to escape from a certain pattern or habit, or just having no good options and having tried everything and knowing better, but it's just not shifting. There's no flexibility or suppleness to the experience, and it's deeply frustrating, and it can be mild or it can be severe, it can be acute or it can be chronic. But I think people know when they're stuck, and that's the experience that I'm trying to address. So starting from that place, not what's your trauma, but what's your stuckness, then we can say, okay, are you willing to get unstuck on this walk? Are you willing to have an event, a conversation that gets you unstuck, which would leave you responsible for the choices you make, because all of a sudden you'd have some choices. And there's a part of us when we're stuck that has no interest in getting unstuck because there are perks to it. So I try to recruit the part of us that is actually hungry for a different experience like clarity or freedom or peace or other parts of our best selves that go missing in action when we're stuck. And from there, I have the license, not the professional license, but I have the interpersonal license, you could say, to intervene and to say to the person, okay, well, given that on this walk, we're not going to shift anything in the external circumstances, what can we shift to give you a different experience? Well, it better be your point of view. So we got to find out what your point of view is and see what's misaligned about your point of view. Is it the internal logic of it? Is it the premises of it? Is it related to reality? Is it coming from a long time ago and it's not related to now? And once a person has set an intention to get unstuck and has a taste for what that might be like, the perks of the stuckness start to turn kind of ashy in the mouth, you know? And all of a sudden there's a kind of like, oh yeah, right. And that's the crack. And I live for that. I mean, and I'm a dog on a bone, you know, until we get to that moment. I designed it, including the walking part, which I do both in person and by phone or Zoom. It's designed around me being most alive. I'm at my best when I'm walking, and I'm at my best when I have the leeway to get in there and responsibly and lovingly, but sometimes pretty ruthlessly, intervene in a person's point of view that's not serving them.
Just like the chiropractor. Wow, well, I think we'd all like to go on one of those walks and see what cracks would come out or not. As you say, there are perks in staying in that comfort zone sometimes. I always love what Mel Robbins says about being stuck, that when you're thirsty, you need to drink. When you're hungry, you need to eat. And when you're stuck, you need to grow. And I'm sure you get growth from the conversations with people and the cracks that happen almost as much as, or at least in tandem with them. It's incredible work that you do.
Thank you. I do get the growth. Sometimes I get an unpleasant spotlight on where I'm not applying the things I'm advocating. And that itself gives me impetus to get unstuck myself and give up my own little Scooby snacks that I get from whatever status quo is I'm mired in. So it does keep the spotlight on me, and I have to keep the instrument clean, or else it starts to get imprecise and I don't enjoy it as much.
Well, thank you so much for making the time to stop by. I know it's been a real whirlwind for you since you landed here in Ireland. The website to find out more about Daniel's work is walkwithdaniel.com. You'll also find him on Instagram at Daniel B. Mate, and The Myth of Normal is available in paperback now. And I so appreciate Daniel making the time. He was rather shell-shocked and moved by the Irish ability to come together and congregate. In fact, he said as much. I'm sure he slept the whole flight back to America. So that's it for Live and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Aidan McKelvey, and Hugo Da Silva Scott, who was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.